This is an ABC podcast.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump has unleashed in a series of extraordinary social media posts, swearing and threatening Iran's civilian infrastructure if the Strait of Hormuz isn't reopened. So are we on the edge of a dangerous escalation in this war that has already wrought havoc on energy markets? And while time ticks down on Trump's deadline, buyers seem to be biding their time to purchase property in Australia, with the auction clearance rates continuing to fall. Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC business correspondent David Taylor.
So, DT, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
The long weekend has interrupted the usual flow of market trading, and Trump is demonstrating this pattern of making his most inflammatory remarks when markets are closed. What do you make of the most recent social media posts and the comments that he has made to journalists regarding this deadline? Are we at the point of a further escalation in this war?
Well, if you look at the social media posts, then yes. But what I am struggling with is an existential journalism crisis. That's what I'm struggling with, because what are the tweets supposed to be doing? Are they supposed to be scaring the Iranians? Are they supposed to be moving markets? Are they supposed to be hedging Donald Trump's own personal interests? I have no idea. And as a journalist, you are used to receiving information from different sources. Some of those sources are credible, some of them aren't. And to have a moment where the source is the President of the United States, you would assume it's credible. But the social media posts are contradictory. What he says is contradictory. So as a journalist, it is really annoying. It's literally giving me a headache and confusion, which is leading to a small level of nausea, because it's exhausting. You don't have that usual flow of what information am I getting? Where's the source? How can I verify that source? And then how can I convey that to an audience? That process has been short-circuited, if you like. So it's impossible to work out. Based on what I've seen over the weekend, I would say that there is a real threat that over the next 48 hours, there will be either a serious escalation of the war or Donald Trump will find another off-ramp. But again, Carrington, this idea of an off-ramp, I'd never heard of an off-ramp before this Iran war started. I mean, what is an off-ramp? I mean, I think of a boat coming off a ramp just in my own head. Like that's what I think of an off-ramp, or a car. You know, and think of it as a strategy to exit a major war just annoys me.
Yeah, Donald Trump is a difficult political figure to cover because he doesn't play by the usual rules when it comes to conveying information. Previously, it might be a case that a politician might choose not to say something or might avoid potential answers if they thought it could get in the way of operations. But Donald Trump is very available to media. He is constantly doing interviews with media, different media organizations, often back to back and seemingly contradicting himself as the hours tick by. And then we have these social media posts, which are a direct line, as he sees it, to the American people and to the world. And as you say, it's confusing in these social media posts. Are they just meant as a form of brinkmanship? Is it him trying to convey to the Iranian regime that he does mean business and he is going to go through with these threats to bomb them back to the Stone Age in his terminology? Or is this a message to the American people that he wants to look like a strongman? Is it a message to other world leaders, again, to convey a certain position?
You've been in Washington, though. When you're with the press gallery in Washington, what is the sense from other American journalists? Do they take every word verbatim, or is it?
No, and I think people struggled with this concept, right? Because on one hand, he is the American president and he is the source of information. He is a legitimate source of information because he does know what they are planning behind the scenes. But as he himself will say often when answering these questions, I wouldn't tell you even if I was, when people asked him about putting ground forces into the region. And so on this particular issue about this impending deadline, we've seen him move the goalposts now multiple times when it comes to opening up the Strait of Hormuz. He gave them 48 hours. He moved it out by a week. He then moved it out to 5 days, and he moved it out to 10 days. He seems to be sticking to this current deadline, and the language has become more inflammatory. But then at one point during this 10-day period, he also said, or the White House said, the opening of the Strait of Hormuz was not necessarily a priority of the American administration. So I think it could well be that we're at the point of an escalation. It's also possible he finds a way of avoiding that deadline, but you would be wrong to discount the possibility completely. And I think one of the things that's interesting when we look at the market implications for this is that on one hand, you have organizations like the International Energy Agency suggesting that this is the worst interruption of the flow of energy in history. You know, we're on par with what was going on in the 1970s, which would indicate that we could be on the edge of a major economic disaster. But markets, yes, they have fallen, but they appear to be mostly shrugging this off, right? We actually saw a bounce back last week. So is it that investors are choosing to be optimistic, or is it that they're based on their experience with Donald Trump, they think eventually the market cost to him, which is in turn translates into a political cost to him, will be so high that he will try to find that mystic off ramp.
Look, I go by the efficient markets hypothesis, and I do believe that I'm a markets purist. I do believe that markets are telling a story. And what was interesting last Thursday when Donald Trump was speaking, and everyone wanted to know every word of that that announcement, that update on Iran, when he said that he promised to commit to finishing the job, to completing the job in Iran, the oil price was at around about $104 a barrel. We're talking Brent, the global benchmark. It fell to around $99 a barrel before he said that. And then as soon as he said, I'm going to complete this job, it moved very gradually from $99 a barrel to $104, then $105, $106. And as we're delivering this podcast now to our audience, both West Texas Intermediate and Brent Crude are trading at around about $110 to $112 a barrel. So what that tells me is that despite everything that has been said up until this point, the market is applying a premium to the price of oil. The market is saying the taco trade is gone for the moment. Trump always chickens out, meaning he will take something to the brink and then at the very last moment bring it back, and markets will breathe a sigh of relief. That trade for the moment has been put to the side. And what markets are looking at is this idea of, does the US president have control over this firefight now? And some say yes, a majority say no, he doesn't have control. He's looking for an off-ramp, can't find it. Looking for an off-ramp over here, can't find it. So the markets are pricing that in. As people try to get cash and liquidate their positions, you're seeing the price of gold sell off. Huge bubble in the price of gold. And now we're looking at the price of gold about 16-17% down from its all-time high, and it's consistently now in a bear market. So central banks and other major investors are liquidating gold in order to cash up their positions. So you've got a premium in the price of oil. You've got gold being sold off to cover margin calls or any kind of leverage position where people need cash. And the equity market still is down. Any equity market across the globe is still down between 7-10%. So there is hope. There is hope that things will work out, but there is a broader thematic that Donald Trump doesn't have control over this situation anymore, and I think that premium is being placed in the oil market.
One of the difficulties with the taco trade has been, and the reason people talk about this is we saw, for example, when it came to the Liberation Day tariffs, which is really where this terminology came from, that Donald Trump announces this sweeping reform of the way that America taxes countries that try to export to the United States, and he went with some extraordinary tariffs on individual countries. And it looked like he was going to hold on to that tariff position even when we started to see major sell-offs in markets. But eventually it appeared it got too much for him, particularly with what was happening in the bond market. And so here we saw him pare back considerably the tariffs that were being placed. The main one was on China, where we got up to, you know, extraordinary heights. But I think this is starting to remind me more of what happened during the COVID pandemic. And just like with the COVID pandemic, Donald Trump did not have control of the virus. And although he would go to these daily briefings, and he actually used terminology last week that echoed almost exactly what he said with COVID, which is that it'll be like a miracle, eventually it'll just disappear. And that was the same terminology he used when it came to the Strait of Hormuz. So, you know, it'll just open up almost naturally. It'll just reopen once we leave. And what experts are now suggesting when it comes to energy supply is that there is not going to be a miraculous recovery in oil supply. Not only have we seen infrastructure destroyed or badly damaged around the Gulf, on the Iranian side, but also in the Gulf states, but also there is going to be much greater fear about ships moving through that strait, even if we don't have a hot war, as it were, between the United States and Iran, that they can now quickly become potential targets if something else happens. And also just a general dislocation over how markets are supplied. And so how quickly can we actually restore the flow of energy and fertilizer and other key components of the global economy, even if Donald Trump does declare mission accomplished and decides to pull out? And I think it is fascinating to me that we haven't seen stronger sell-offs on markets, but I think it is people betting on the fact that Donald Trump won't want to face a midterm election with a war still raging or with Americans still paying more for their petrol, what they call gas, come November. But the question is, can you actually unpick the damage you've already done? Or, like COVID, when you have a virus running rampant through a population, it doesn't really matter what Donald Trump does or doesn't want to say about the state of reality. What matters is reality. And at the moment, the reality is high energy prices and real concerns about global growth.
I think markets need to believe there is some semblance of normality here and that there is some sense of getting out of this. And so whenever I look at this, forget Tarko, when I look at this and I see a massive news event that is clearly bearish, you know, clearly sends the price of oil up, clearly sends equity markets down and a bond sell-off. The second there is even a whiff of relief in terms of news, a Truth Social post by Donald Trump or something indicating that a ship has sailed through the Strait of Hormuz under relative safety, whatever it is, there is an enormous rush of buying back into the market. So when that changes, I don't know. But I think markets are genuinely frightened of what will happen if the truth is revealed.
So this is a major international crisis that investors are trying to make sense of, but obviously it has implications here in Australia. Mm. We have seen the Australian share market, I think the last count was down 6.7% from the recent high. Obviously, as we speak now, the market is closed for the Easter Monday holiday. We wait to see what happens tomorrow on deadline day. But we are also in a situation where Australians are facing much higher prices for fuel. There's real concern about the flow-through effects, the second round effects when it comes to those higher energy costs feeding into grocery bills to all your basic expenses, and then you keep going and then it potentially feeds into higher inflation when it comes to services, etc. What do you make of the government's response so far? And the state of the Australian economy, and potentially for many people, the biggest question, where it leaves us as far as interest rates are concerned.
Oh, that's...
It's a lot.
Look, in terms of the government's response, I mean the classic example is that the halving of the petrol excise and the fuel excise, and then coming in on top of that with an extra tax cut. It's a pragmatic, practical solution. Drive past a petrol station now rather than in Sydney, rather than the price of petrol unleaded being at $1.60, it's at $1.20 for regular unleaded. So that's a practical example of walking away with $20 otherwise that you wouldn't have. So it's all good. But I think what is being discounted here is a sense of anxiety and panic about what's around the corner. And doing that doesn't relieve that. So the Prime Minister came out last week for an address that was then rebutted by the opposition leader. And again, it's about calming folks down, and whether that works or not, it's up to the individual. But the government is looking at this from a pragmatic financial point of view and a psychological point of view. And I suspect that, I don't know, but I suspect the government is doing as much as it sees it can at the moment, but with the fact that there is a structural deficit and we have almost $1 trillion worth of gross debt. So there isn't much fat to cut out in terms of paying for relief, financial relief in terms of the budget. And then you're left with the economic situation, which is the inflation was already elevated. Now, the 3-4% inflation, people thinking about that might think, well, 3-4%, I think we can probably cope with that. Well, central banks around the world have said, no, 2.5% inflation is what will lead to everyone feeling, you know, happy and jolly. So 3-4% to start off with underlying inflation and then moving up to sort of 4 or 5 or 6, which is what Treasury and some economists are forecasting will ultimately happen here, is going to be problematic. So you've got that, an already elevated level of inflation, moving higher. You know, job vacancies look okay at the moment, but unemployment could easily deteriorate from here. And then you've got that awful low growth, high unemployment, high inflation environment, which the central bank can't deal with in terms of money printing because inflation's already high. And the federal government's got very little fiscal maneuvering. So I don't like it. I don't like it at all. What do you think?
I think we already had inflation too hot for the Reserve Bank's liking heading into this year, which is why we saw the initial interest rate hike, which I think sometimes people now forget in the kind of fog of war that actually we were already moving up with interest rate hikes before the first Israeli-American strikes on Iran. It's obviously only exacerbated the problem, and that's why the betting has changed to potentially having a third, fourth, maybe even fifth interest rate hike this year. The government has a very difficult balance to try to work through come this budget. On one hand, I think they did want this to be a reforming budget. They wanted to show that they were making significant changes to the way the Australian government taxes the population and then where it spends its money. That potentially becomes more difficult if people are already feeling the burn of paying higher fuel costs and all the other associated costs. So, yeah, I think this is going to be a difficult budget for them to try to figure out exactly what the population is willing to accept from their government. But at the same time, as the expression goes, never waste a crisis. We've spoken about this a few times. Potentially, it makes the argument easier when it comes to taxing certain things, and there is some chatter about potentially changing the way that we tax resources, for example. One of the things I have been watching very closely in the last few weeks is what's happening in the property market. And so we had last year a property market running well above what I think the government wanted it to be doing, and I think what the Australian population probably at large wanted it to be doing. You know, people knew it was getting increasingly difficult for first home buyers to get into the market. There was a focus by state governments about and from the federal government about trying to increase the supply of housing to try to deal with what was very clearly an acute problem in allowing people to be able to get onto that property ladder. The gear shift this year in the last month is quite extraordinary. Although we don't have property being priced in the way we have equities on a kind of daily market, you can really see the impact, can't you, in the auction clearance rates. Last weekend, because of the holiday weekend, there were way less properties up for auction, less than 700 versus more than 4,000 the week before. But it really has shown that the market has shifted, and the balance of power seems to have squarely shifted to the buyer's side. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And what I'm about to say might be very controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway. I don't think that in the next 6-12 months that supply will have anything to do with the Australian property market. I think that there is every chance that Donald Trump will find an off-ramp. The Iranian oil crisis will come to a close, and it will take months, weeks, if not months, for things to sort themselves out and come back to normal. It's a real prospect. It's a real possibility. Alternatively, this doesn't stop. The price of oil will skyrocket, inflation will skyrocket, and central banks and governments will have absolutely no idea what to do. And they will, you know, at the margin, try and help people with limited firepower. But in that sort of situation, you don't just have an inflation going to 5 or 6%. You have unemployment going to 5, 6, 7%. And with the high unemployment rate, It's kryptonite for markets. So I can see, for the first time in a generation, a scenario. I'm not saying it's going to play out. I have no idea how to put a probability on this. But I can see a scenario playing out where you have unemployment moving up to a level which causes a correction in the Australian property market. And the reason why I discount supply is because you cannot pay your mortgage if you don't have a job. Yes, people have buffers. Absolutely, people have buffers. And any data that you get from the Commonwealth Bank, ANZ, Westpac and NAB show that people are well in front of their repayments. So there's no suggestion of defaults anytime soon. But that is a finite situation. If you have an unemployment rate elevated for over 6-12 months, people need to sell their homes. Again, it's an outside possibility, but it's the first time I have been looking at the property market where I can see something like this eventuating under a worst-case scenario. What do you think?
I think we need to be very careful, not scaring the horses too much on this issue. I mean, I think the default position is, as the Reserve Bank has said, as other leading economists have said, that Australia will be able to muddle through this uncertainty relatively well intact, and that the unemployment rate remains historically low and relatively low compared to many other countries. We are benefiting on one hand from higher energy costs because we are a net exporter of energy. We're getting higher prices for our gas. We're getting higher prices for our coal. The government budget's going to be beefed up because of that. That money can be used to support industries in different ways. Obviously, when we went through the COVID pandemic, I remember the fear at the beginning of that pandemic about what would happen to the property market and real concerns about mass layoffs, and that would lead to people, as you say, defaulting on mortgages, being in stress, being forced selling of property into the market and a market that was fearful and concerned. In fact, what we saw was eventually, the property market once again took off because we saw huge amounts of government support, first of all, for the economy, but also interest rates were cut. And the Reserve Bank actually now has a lot of firepower up its sleeve, right?
That's true.
The interest rates are pretty high right now. There's lots of cuts to be made if they need to make them. One thing I will say about following the property market for a long time is it's very hard to bet against the Australian property market. There are many theoretical reasons why you can come up with why the Australian property market is overpriced when you try to link it to how much people earn income-wise, when you try to work out what a fundamental fair cost of that property is. But what we have seen over decades now is, in most places, property prices continuing to go up, and that's partly because it's seen as a safe place for investment, but also because Australia has very high population growth. I mean, the most recent statistics from the ABS show population still growing by 1.6%, more than 400,000 people moving to Australia. Those people need to be housed somewhere. And so that does mean that there's demand for more housing. And that's why I think we've seen it. But you're right to point out there are risks here. And anyone who thinks property is a one-way bet has not looked at different countries around the world 100%. Who've had long periods of high house property price growth only to see something hit that market, and then you can see value dissipate.
You have to admit, the preliminary clearance rates are interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing is sellers are just not getting the price that they thought their house is worth a month ago. And I think talking to real estate agents, they say the biggest difficulty for them right now is trying to convince a seller that this current price is the proper price. The value of the house is whatever someone's willing to pay for it, not what it was a month ago.
Can't you? Wow.
I mean, this is for most
people.
Because
people get really emotionally attached to this stuff.
I think they get emotionally attached to the house particularly that they live in, but also I think for most people, this is your biggest investment.
100%.
And if you've suddenly gone from your house being worth whatever the number might be, and now it's worth, they're telling you it's worth 10% than what you thought it was a month ago in some extreme examples, then of course that's a difficult discussion to have.
It's literally coming up in the data, though. That tension is there. which is fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And it is also, you know, it's one of the most clear examples of how this international energy crisis is impacting Australian property. Now, DT, that is all the time we have to. We could speak for hours, but thank you so much for joining us on ABC Business Daily.
Thanks, Garrison.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question, we'd love to hear it. Email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, DT.
Bye-bye.